Hello, once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me in the Bettors Box, BettingTheBook.com's MLB betting podcast for Monday, April 1st. I am your host, Adam Burke. This and every edition of the Bettors Box, presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook, BTB, and the number 200 is that promo code, 100% deposit match bonus for the Sportsbook, 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. Started off today with the Monday mailbag. Do you ever have questions for the Monday mailbag at Skating Tripods on Twitter or Adam at bangthebook.com via email? Make sure you're checking out my daily picks and tips piece. We're off to a little bit of a slow start here so far. A tough first week in Major League Baseball, but definitely looking to get back on the right track here this week. And, you know, also too, again, not to make excuses, but, you know, when you talk about this business, when you talk about what it entails to be a handicapper day after day after day, if you're a professional bettor, for those of you that are listening out there, you certainly know this, but you know, it's one of those things where you have to be organized, you have to be focused, you have to know everything that's going on across Major League Baseball. And you know, for me last week, out in Vegas, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, did the article on Thursday from the hotel room, Friday, first day back, Saturday, Sunday, you know, really in a lot of ways to draw a parallel, not that I'm a professional athlete or anything like that. When we talk about situational spots, we talk about teams playing that first game back off of a road trip, things of that sort, you know, you got some things you got to take care of once you get back on the home front. So happy to be back in a regular rhythm, in a regular schedule here this week. I would fully expect that things start to go better here for us this week and beyond as we get some more data and also as I get a chance to settle in, do a little bit more study, things of that sort. But again, check out that picks and tips piece every day over at bangthebook.com. Speaking of daily picks and tips, Kyle Hunter still doing college basketball for as long as we've got that going. Parker Michaels doing the NHL regular season and through the playoffs. If you want to know what it's like to take an Adderall laced with speed, watch the NHL playoffs. Personally, I've never done that, but I can only assume that it's a lot like the postseason in pucks. Parker will go through the playoffs, so you definitely want to make sure that you're checking that out. Wednesday here on Bang the Book Radio, I'll talk with Kyle Hunter about the Final Four in the National Championship. Thursday, we'll have another edition of the Bettors Box. Not going to do anything on Tuesday this week. We'll pick up on Tuesday next week with Brian Blessing, taking a look at the Masters. But for now, we'll go Monday, Wednesday, Thursday here this week. No UFC next weekend, so nothing on Friday either. But Monday, Wednesday, Thursday this week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday next week for sure, and probably Friday as well. So we'll keep you posted as much as we can here on Bang the Book Radio with our different one-off segments and stuff like that. But as I mentioned before, we'll do things like the Masters, the Kentucky Derby, college football season win totals. I know NFL win totals came out at CG here this week, so maybe I'll look to do that on Friday, something like that. We'll try to get a lot of Bang the Book Radio content out to you, but the one constant for sure will be the Bettors Box on Mondays and Thursdays. So you'll have that to look forward to here over the course of the Major League Baseball season. All right, so let's dive into this April 1st edition of the show. We'll start things off with the Monday mailbag, then I'll go beyond the box score, give you some observations, some series recaps. As we get deeper into the season and have more data, I'll be doing things regarding exit velocity and updating some of those things, pitchers with big ERA and xFIP discrepancies, all that. For right now, just taking a look back at the series that we saw here this past weekend. Then I'll go down the lines, talk about line moves that we've seen from Thursday when I was last on the air, give you my pick for Monday night, and then also preview the week ahead. So we start with the Monday mailbag here. Again, at Skating Tripods on Twitter or Adam at bangthebook.com if you want to reach out here. And I'm going to start actually with an NHL question that I got. I've got baseball questions otherwise, but I'm going to start with an NHL question here from at Pick Management on Twitter. Says, I've been following the in-game trends found in this article. It was an article over at Odd Shark about teams scoring first versus not scoring first and with leads after a period. The streaks some teams are on so far overshadow the follow the money five streaks, which is a VSiN show where they've been talking about a lot of first period overs and things of that sort. So it says, how much weight do you lend to this? Well, you know, obviously you want to score first in any sport. I mean, that's a given, but some teams are better equipped to play when trailing than others. You know, defensive teams, they give up a goal early. They're going to shut it down. They're not going to be down 2 or 3 to nothing. They're going to give themselves a chance to come back in that game. Meanwhile, teams with other styles, you know, maybe they do fall down 2 or 3 nothing. You're probably not going to come back from that. So defensive teams that fall behind early, probably decent live bets in the NHL because those are teams that will keep it a 1-0 game, will eventually get their chances, probably going to have a better record when trailing after the first period. Now, on the flip side of that, obviously, you know, if you're a team that doesn't play very good defense, even if you can score, if you score first and you don't play good defense, well, maybe this all of a sudden you're down 2-1 or 3-1 or something like that. So I think to a degree it matters. I mean, look, you're always going to have teams, and you can see this in baseball too, with teams that score the first run. You're always going to have teams that are really bad when they don't score first and really good, in a relative sense, of course, if they don't score first. So I think there's some credence. I think there's some merit to it. Not a ton, I don't think, because, you know, you're going to have teams that are just better off at playing with the lead, better off that, you know, better off at coming from behind than others, stuff like that. So I don't lend a ton of weight to it. I guess from a live betting standpoint, there probably are some opportunities. But, you know, to be honest with you, I really haven't followed the follow the money thing too much in the NHL, so I can't really comment to that. I do know that first period overs have been really good for a lot of different teams out there. But, you know, as far as scoring first, trailing first, all that type of thing, a lot of those things follow pretty constant trends. So I don't think there's too much validity to it. But again, if you are a team that really shuts it down defensively, you can keep it a 1-0 game, wait to get your spots. I think there are some good live betting opportunities on teams like that. So appreciate the question at Pick Management. Probably not the answer you were necessarily looking for. But you know, if you want to hit me up via email, adam@bangthebook.com, we can talk about it a little bit more. At Down on the Dog sends me a question here this morning. Says, Adam, I was curious, what's the reasoning that Goldie bats second in that Cards lineup? And I love lineup construction questions. And, you know, I used to obsess over lineup construction. Even dating back to last year, I would obsess over lineup construction. When you read a little bit more into it, it's fair to wonder how much it actually matters. Now, in a statistical sense, it should matter. Because as you look at plate appearances by batting order from last season, leadoff hitters, 22,631. This is league-wide, by the way. 22,631 for leadoff hitters, 22,132 for number two hitters, 21,614 for three hitters, 21,129 for four hitters, 20,642 for five hitters. So basically with each lineup spot you drop, that's about 500 fewer plate appearances league-wide. So obviously you've got the 30 teams there, and you know some teams just don't hit very well, so maybe it's a gap of 15 plate appearances. For the Indians last year, for example, their number two hole hitter had 755 plate appearances. The number three hole hitter had 730. So 25 extra plate appearances per season. It could be meaningful, depending on the gap between your number two hitter and your number three hitter. So obviously if you're a manager, you'd like to construct your lineup as optimally as possible. Now, when you talk about why you would slot guys in certain places, your leadoff hitter, you want to get on base. You really don't want a power guy in your leadoff spot. Some teams have been gravitating towards doing this, but really you want the highest on-base percentage guy batting leadoff. Not to say that a home run doesn't do you any good, but when you talk about home runs from leadoff hitters, 7 out of 10 are going to be solo shots. When you talk about home runs from other batting places in the order, about 6.5 to 6.3 out of 10 are going to be solo shots. So you'd certainly like to try and maximize your power potential by putting those better power guys a little bit further down the order, but you still want that on-base percentage guy up top. I think in a lot of ways now, it used to be that teams would put their number three hitter, their best all-around hitter in the number three spot. But when you talk about something like that, you're a number three hitter, you're going to come up with two outs and nobody on more often than any other spot in the batting order. Just because, you know, you talk about the leadoff, the first inning, leadoff guy and the number two guy go down, your number three hitter all of a sudden up with nobody on and two outs. So that spot in the batting order, simply because of the first inning, will come up with two out and nobody on more often than any other spot in the order. So really, I think you want your best all-around hitter batting second, which for the St. Louis Cardinals is Paul Goldschmidt. You want your best overall hitter batting second because he still gets a lot of plate appearances. And he's also going to have that opportunity to set the table for those 3, 4, 5 guys. Used to be you'd have, you know, those control batters, those guys that'll hit you 280, but have a 320 on base percentage. But, hey, they put the ball in play and they move runners and all that stuff. Used to have those guys batting second. Well, the game has changed. People have gotten smarter within the game. So I think your best all-around hitter should bat second. In the case of the Cardinals, it is Paul Goldschmidt. So I do think that it makes a lot of sense. Certainly you'd want kind of a contact guy in that three hole, maybe a little bit lower of an on-base percentage guy, but a guy that's going to hit for average. Maybe he has a little bit of pop as well because Again, if you come up with two out and nobody on, you hit a solo home run. At least you get something out of the inning. So, you know, your three hitter, you want to be a really strong contact guy to where if he's in one of those run producing situations, he's going to put the ball in play. If he's not, he's going to extend innings, give you a chance for the four and five guys to come up. And this is where you want your power threats. This is where you want your doubles and extra base hits guys, because these are the guys that come up with the most runners on base in the four and five holes. So you want to try to balance this as much as you possibly can, but also to get your best hitters as many plate appearances as possible. Now, your best hitter is kind of a vague definition, because is it your power guy? Is it your on-base guy? Is it your batting average guy? Well, you try to find a good balance of all of those things. So leadoff, you want on-base percentage. Two-hole hitter should be your best all-around guy. Three-hole hitter, probably your best average guy. Four and five, your best power guys. That's the way that I would construct a lineup if I was a manager. So I think that the Cardinals are doing the right thing with Paul Goldschmidt batting second in that order. And you just hope that, you know, the other guys around him are able to do their jobs and sort of maximize the value that he provides you in that spot. At Contrarian Sport on Twitter says, I was wondering what your thoughts are regarding live betting baseball. Do you see much value there? Absolutely. I think there's a lot of value in live betting baseball. Bullpen usage is a big part of it. You know, because if you get into a situation, obviously the Milwaukee Brewers are going to be the most obvious example. Look, they've used Josh Hader in two of their four games. They've won both of those games. The other game was Sunday where they had to come from behind victory 5-4 where they didn't need him. And then the other game was Friday where they didn't have him and got badly outscored in the sixth through eighth innings. So if you know that a team will not be using its top reliever, that's a live betting opportunity for you, especially if it's not a bullpen with a lot of depth where the best guy really does stand out in a lot of ways. I think, for example, the Indians, if Brad Hand is unavailable to close games this year, it's going to kind of throw their bullpen hierarchy all out of whack. So if Brad Hand's pitching, you know, a third straight day or four and five, something like that, I'd probably look for live betting opportunities to fade the Indians. I think there are a lot of opportunities based on who's available out there in the bullpen to make some plus EV live betting wagers. Now, I think this or next year, this is going to be really interesting. Once Major League Baseball incorporates the three batter minimum, and you've got a lefty who maybe has ugly platoon splits, you know, and the lineup goes lefty, righty, lefty, and there's some guys on base or something like that, well, that could be a really interesting live betting situation. So that'll be something to watch for next year, not incorporated here this year. But some other angles that you want to look at. Starters that struggle the third time through the order. This is a very good thing for you to look at. It's a very good thing to familiarize yourself with. Look around Fangraphs, or maybe I'll try to do this at some point. But look around Fangraphs when you get some downtime. Find those guys that are really bad the third time through the order. Open up a Word document. Open up Notes, Google Docs, whatever the hell it is that you use. Write those guys down. Because if they're up 3-2 going into the fifth inning or something like that, that may be a live betting opportunity to fade that guy. A lot of pitchers struggle the third time through the order. So those are definitely live betting opportunities you can look to take advantage of. And also, aggressive managers. I think you can find some live betting opportunities between the aggressive managers and the ones that are a little bit more passive. Because the passive guys going to leave that starter out there, going to get that, try to get that starter through five innings to get the win, stuff like that. The aggressive guys, they're going to say, I don't care. They're going to go out there and get a fresh arm. What's better, a starter the third time through the order or a new reliever? Well, in every metric you're going to look at, the correct answer is a new reliever. So aggressive managers are going to be very good live betting opportunists as well, because those are guys that, you know, are going to get a fresh arm out there with a different look, a different arm slot. You know, it can be a big advantage. So I think there are definitely opportunities from a live betting standpoint. Bullpen usage and who's available. Starters the third time through the order. Aggressive managers. Those are the three most telltale signs that I would look for here when it comes to live betting baseball, because I think those are the best chances to take advantage of what's going on with the flow of a game. At Randy Back on Twitter says, I find baseball to have higher variance compared to most other North American sports. That being said, if you're betting favorites of minus 200 or more, do you increase your bet size to win your regular unit size, or is the risk not worth the reward? Something I talked about last Thursday in the Bettors Box here was favorites of minus 181 or higher and how profitable that angle has been over the last several years. I think it's back to 2013 where it didn't turn a blind profit, either 2013 or 2014. I ran the query here at Killer Sports this morning for minus 200 or higher favorites. Last year, minus 200 or higher favorites, 337 and 108, 75.7%, $100 bettors up over $8,000, almost 8,200 per Killer Sports. Those are closing lines, and I believe that Killer Sports grades against five dimes lines. I could be wrong. I'll try and reach out and get the correct answer for that. I believe it's against five dimes lines, though. 2017, minus 200 or higher favorites, 229 and 71, 76.3%, $100 bettors up almost $6,300 on the minus 200 favorites. So that should be an answer to your question, that these are reliable enough that you should be able to increase your bet size to win your regular unit size. Now, that being said, the caveat is this time of year, because a lot of teams are still trying to get into the flow of the season. And look, we just saw Baltimore, you know, play very well against the Yankees, with the Yankees as a substantial favorite in all of those games. I'd be wary of it right now, playing the big favorites, laying the big numbers. But as the season goes along, yes, I would play normal bet sizes to win normal unit sizes, because once these good teams kind of shake off the rust, get into the rhythms of the season, they're going to be the good team more often than not over that bad team. Right now, it's a little bit dicey because everybody's kind of on equal footing. You know, yes, there are higher talent levels around the league, but hitting conditions are bad in a lot of places. You know, pitchers are still trying to get into the swing of things. I mean, look, let's be honest here. You've got some pitchers right now that are pitching this weekend that haven't pitched in a week or 8 or 9 days because teams wanted to keep their primary starters on their regular turns. If you've got guys that are having their turn skipped the first time through the rotation, they may pitch next week for the first time in 2 weeks. So I'd be very wary of the big favorites at time of the year in the month of April. But as we go along, I would not be scared of chalk in Major League Baseball. You know, you look at the results, and it's been proven that betting the big money line favorites does turn a profit for you. Again, that's not to say you want to do it blindly. It's not to say you want to bet all of them. But it's just to say that you can bet into some of these big favorites with a higher degree of confidence, especially if you find matchup advantages and things of that sort that, you know, really do look to be in your favor there. So great questions for the Monday mailbag here today. Again, at Skating Tripods on Twitter or Adam at bangthebook.com. If you ever have a question here, whether it's about baseball or about something else, happy to answer it on the program. All right, so let's go beyond the box score here. And I'll start by mentioning this. Just talked about the big favorites, and this is a big reason why I'm wary of favorites this time of the year. Favorites through 53 games, only 29 and 24. Dogs have shown a profit across the board. This is usually the time that betting underdogs is pretty good. Last year, it wasn't the case, I believe. I think last year, favorites were really chalk heavy in April and did a very good job. Usually, underdogs wind up being pretty feisty here in the month of April. So, again, when you're playing the big favorites, I think later in the year, the better time to do that, especially as teams kind of realize, you know, what their future holds for this season. Right now, just about everybody thinks they have a shot at the playoffs. So, again, favorites just 29 and 24 here so far. Dogs have definitely shown a profit across the board. Speaking of which, let's talk about the Rockies and Marlins here. The Rockies took the first two in this series with Kyle Freeland and Herman Marquez, lost the last two in the series with Tyler Anderson and John Gray. Now, John Gray did pitch really well. Probably deserved a better fate, 10 strikeouts over 6 2/3. Rockies, 8 shutout against Sandy Alcantara. So the Marlins got some pretty good pitching here in this series overall. Jose Urena had some bumps in the road. Pablo Lopez struggled the third time through the order. But outside of that, you know, the Marlins got some pretty good starting pitching here in this series. Trevor Richards was very, very good. Lopez didn't have the best command, but the stuff looked pretty lively. So for the Marlins here, you know, and they're taking money again today in their game against the New York Mets. You know, the Marlins looked pretty competent in this series. And, you know, for the Rockies, I mean, look, this is how it's going to be most of the year. Freeland and Marquez will be the guys they rely on. Whoever winds up in the back end of this rotation, they'll hope to win a fair number of those games. But Gray was good. Again, an ERA, xFIP guy. Would expect line moves on him. as we go throughout the season here. Had the 10 strikeouts, so the stuff was good. Only gave up the one home run, but wasn't able to get any kind of run support there in that one. Speaking of home runs, the Marlins hit 5 in this series, 5 over the 4 games. They only hit 53 home runs at home all of last year. So maybe Marlins Park going to play a little better for power. I don't know what to see. They took out the statue, the weird sculpture thing. Maybe the batter's eye will be a little bit different here in Miami. Maybe lends to some more offense at home, particularly in the home run department. We'll have to keep a close eye on that. But again, already just about 10% of the way to last year's home run total in just 4 of the 81 home games for Miami. One note here about the Rockies is that they only drew 8 walks here in the 4 games in this series. And that's a problem because we talk about the Coors Field effect, and we know Colorado is going to be solid offensively at home. They are year in and year out. But on the road, with that Coors Field effect, seeing different spin on pitches, it's just a different kind of environment, different kind of atmosphere. Drawing walks is a big help because you don't have to hit your way on. You know, that it kind of takes a little bit of that Coors Field impact out of the equation some, but only drawing 4 walks here, that's concerning for me with the Rockies going forward. And the more I looked at this team in the lead up to the season, the more I kind of thought about them, the more I kind of tracked them throughout spring training and all that, they do worry me. And now no Daniel Murphy, and I'll talk about it here in a few minutes with the line move for tonight's game, but very top-heavy offense with Nolan Arenado and Trevor Story, which was a concern for me coming into the season. But not drawing walks is a real big issue, especially against a Marlins pitching staff that may be better than we thought, but still isn't all that strong. Indians and Twins. For those that subscribe to my Bettors Box Notes, you're going to find a very colorful word here to describe what the Indians' offense looked like this past weekend against the Twins. Adam at bangthebook.com if you want to get on the notes here for the Bettors Box. But, man, it was not pretty. You know, and look, Jose Berríos shoved. I mean, Jose Berríos was fantastic, lowered his fastball usage down to 49%, very heavy curveball usage, 38.5%. I don't know if that's sustainable for him over the course of the season. That's a lot of strain on the arm. But I can tell you what, if he keeps that curveball usage in the 30 to 35% range, lowers the fastball usage, uses the secondaries, we're looking at the breakout season for Jose Berríos here this year. 18 swings and misses in that game against the Indians, and quite frankly, could have been more than that with how good his stuff was. Gotta like him a lot going into the season here. Jake Odorizzi pitched really well in the middle game. Now, the Indians did find a way to win that one, won that game on 2 wild pitches from Blake Parker, essentially. But Odorizzi really elevated the fastball well, 16 of 17 swings and misses on the fastball. Lots of two-seam movement to it at the end, throwing it above the belt with a lot of success. I'll be curious to see if that was the Twins picking up on an Indians weakness or if that's what they're going to do with Jake Odorizzi this year to try and if you can throw the fastball up. Odorizzi is a guy that has a pretty decent changeup usually. You throw it from the same tunnel, you can get guys out in front of that pitch. So the rising two-seam fastball for Odorizzi was a really valuable weapon for him against the Indians. Now, the one big weakness the Indians have always had is the high fastball. So this could have just been a plan against the Indians. I'll be watching that with Odorizzi as we go forward here. But you know, the 11 strikeouts with the elevated fastball, I kind of spent a lot of time on Saturday thinking, well, is the Indians' offense just shitty right now, or did Jake Odorizzi pitch really well? I think it was a combination of a little bit of both, but I want to give more credit to Odorizzi here until I see otherwise, because working 92 in the zone with arm side run to righties and arm side run away from lefties is going to make his fastball really hard to center on. That's a guy where, you know, he's a fly ball pitcher, so he likes to work up in the zone anyway, but you add some of that movement to run in on the handle and run away from the barrel, that should help his home run rate this year. So Odorizzi all of a sudden becomes a lot more interesting to me based on that pitch selection and pitch sequencing that I saw in that start. You look at the Indians pitching staff here. I mean, obviously the offense was awful. Corey Kluber faced 27 batters, only struck out 5. Again, that pitch to contact thing, very sinker heavy, which I think is his worst pitch. Threw more changeups than usual at the expense of his cutter. Maybe he didn't have the feel for the cutter because it was so cold out. But, man, I do not like what we're seeing here from Corey Kluber. And last year it didn't really show up in the numbers, but I don't like anything that's going on right now. The velocity is down. The pitch usage is increasing his contact rate. I don't like these trends at all for Corey Kluber. I think Corey Kluber will be a fade guy for me early on in the season here. Bet against him in that game on Thursday. I think I'll look to do the same. Maybe not here against the White Sox coming up Wednesday, but as we go forward here throughout April and May, I think Corey Kluber will be a fade guy to me. I really do think that'll be the case. Carlos Carrasco looked terrible. Maybe it was thrown to Kevin Plawecki. Maybe he wasn't used to that, but allowed 6 extra base hits to right-handed batters. He allowed only 29 all of last season in 378 plate appearances. So Carrasco was middle a lot. The changeup was flat. The slider had 7 swings and misses. So that still had a little bit of life to it. But if Carrasco doesn't have that changeup and he becomes kind of a fastball slider guy, that's worrisome. He needs that changeup. Maybe he just didn't have a grip for it. Maybe he couldn't get the feel for it in that start that was on Sunday. But, man, not great out of the gate for the Indians here in this series. You know, the outfielders didn't look particularly good in their plate appearances. They didn't make a lot of hard contact. Tons and tons of swings and misses. Not a good look. It's very early, obviously. But, you know, maybe seeing some signs here of concern with the Indians. The one thing that was not concerning, Trevor Bauer's changeup. Oh, man. What an elite weapon. The slider's a plus pitch. The fastball with the two-seam run, the Laminar Express, plus pitch. The curveball, when he's not spiking it, is a plus pitch. Now he adds this changeup, which just had so much depth to it in that start. He's got 4 legit plus pitches. The Trevor Bauer Cy Young train is going to leave the station very early this year. And there could be a lot of teams bidding for his services next year, since it does seem fairly likely that the Indians will move him with his stance on only taking 1-year contracts. Next year, his final year of arbitration eligibility, the Indians probably will look to move him. The Brewers take 3 out of 4 from the Cardinals. Good comeback on Sunday. They're 2-0 in games where Josh Hader's available. They're 1-1 in games when he's not. You know, they were outscored 5-1 in the 6th to 8th innings in that game on Friday with Jack Flaherty up against Freddie Peralta. You know, Josh Hader would have likely pitched in those innings, but he was unavailable. Cardinals took advantage. And, of course, Hader not needed on Sunday. Would have been a back-to-back. Wouldn't have been used anyway. But the Brewers, with that come-from-behind victory and, you know, with this higher upside rotation for the Brewers here, Yulis Chacin, 7 strikeouts and 5 1/3. Freddie Peralta did struggle. I mentioned that was a really bad matchup for him. Had the 3 strikeouts over 3 innings. Brandon Woodruff, 5 strikeouts over 5 innings. Corbin Burns, 12 strikeouts over 5 innings. So now you've got a Brewers rotation that still has this emphasis on contact management, but now they've added more strikeouts to the equation. 47 strikeouts in those 4 games for that Brewers pitching staff against the Cardinals. Not a good look for St. Louis offensively here in this series, but you know, for the Brewers, again, you've got a much higher upside rotation. We'll see what Zach Davies does today as more of a command guy than a swing and miss guy. With that higher upside in that rotation, the Brewers are going to be a pretty interesting team from a first 5 standpoint this year. On, you know, really, I think if the rotation is actually better, could limit some of the exposure with those bullpen injuries that could wind up rearing their ugly heads here this season, with Corey Knebel officially going for Tommy John, with the team apparently not able to afford Craig Kimbrell, with Jeremy Jeffress still on the shelf. That's one of the areas of concern for the Brewers, is that bullpen. But if the starters are going to get that many swings and misses in the games, well, that could help them a little bit. This Cardinals bullpen is a concern. You know, Andrew Miller, 2 appearances, 2 runs. Jordan Hicks with the blown save yesterday. Alex Reyes is going to wind up becoming a lot more important for this bullpen with Dakota Hudson in the rotation. John Gant, John Brebbia, both a couple of good relievers. But, you know, they want the back end guys to be Miller and Hicks. And it looks like some early concerns with those two guys. In particular, Miller. I mean, Hicks, it kind of is what it is. The blown saves happen. When you throw 100, you got high margin for error. Andrew Miller just completely burned out by the Indians in the years that they had him. Looked awful, you know, at times over the last 2 seasons. Had the knee injuries. If he's not sharp, that's a problem for this Cardinals back end of the. That's a guy you want to be your 8th inning guy, want to be your shutdown guy. I don't think he has it in him right now. So that's a big worry for me with St. Louis in terms of full game betting. Maybe looking at some first 5s here with the Cardinals, because their bullpen does look to be in a little bit of a state of flux right now. One more series to talk about as we go beyond the box score here. The Red Sox and the Mariners, 58 runs scored at T-Mobile Park in this series. formerly known as Safeco Field. And look, we already see the impact. Today's game between the Angels and the Mariners, a total of 9. 4 games had a total of 9 or higher last season in Seattle. Now we've already got 1 today. So that's a pretty interesting development with the Mariners here for this season. So yeah, that's one of those things where I think that there's some significant overreaction in the betting market, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that total wind up coming down here into the 8.5 range, or at least be 9 with under minus 120, something like that. But, you know, that's one of those things for last season where, you know, it was a bad Mariners offense. I will certainly say that. It was not a good Mariners offense. But it's also one of those things where as you look at this team and as you look at the construction of this team, you do sort of wonder how sustainable this offense is. And I do like this offense quite a bit. I really, truly do. But, you know, how long can this be a thing? Will this offense regress some? Again, 4 totals of 9 or higher last year. Already have one here in this spot. How many of those totals do we get of 9 or higher at T-Mobile Park? So I'm really interested to see how this Mariners offense is able to sustain this. You know, they had the one breakout game there in Tokyo as well. So that's 5 out of 6 games where the Mariners offense has looked pretty damn good. And I do like this group. But, yeah, it looks like it's already getting overvalued, already getting milked into the market here with that total of 9 already at T-Mobile Park. The Red Sox, they've got pitching concerns, man. I mean, the bullpen wasn't awful in this series. It was pretty bad in the game that Chris Sale pitched. That was the concern that I had, was the bullpen. But you look at this rotation. Sale did not look good. Velocity down, slider really flat. Alex Cora kind of downplayed it with the media after that start. But, you know, I watched a decent amount of that one on the plane on the way back, and it wasn't pretty. He had some swings and misses. He had 12 of them. And that's going to happen. But the slider didn't have as much life. It was very inconsistent. And with the velocity decrease, some issues about Sale. You know, Sale's a guy who's kind of been teetering on the brink of, you know, a lot of people don't like the mechanics. A lot of people think that he's a high injury risk guy. Well, not a great first impression here for the 2019 season. I thought too many teams were buying into Nate Eovaldi last year. I hope he figures it out, but he didn't pitch well. My Rick Porcello handicap was dead on. He gave up 9 runs in 2 2/3. He was awful. Eduardo Rodriguez gave up a lot of runs as well, had 13 swings and misses. But look, as much batted ball luck as there was to a degree in this series, the Mariners and that park factor, worrisome signs for this Red Sox pitching staff. Obviously, the offense is going to be just fine, but a lot of overs probably coming this season here for Boston. Again, it's early. You don't want to make too many determinations after 4 or 5 games for these teams. But I think that there are some growing concerns with this Red Sox pitching staff. Speaking of concerns, the Mariners bullpen. Oh, good Lord. You know, that's a Mariners bullpen that was really good last year, largely because of Edwin Diaz, but needs to be good because this starting rotation, a lot of pitch-to-contact guys, it's hard for them to work deep into games. This Seattle bullpen in this series, 13 innings pitched, 10 hits allowed, 9 runs, 4 of them were unearned, 8 walks, 10 strikeouts. Mariners games could have a lot of overs as well. If that lineup is, even if that lineup's not sustainable, the rotation is bad and the bullpen may be worse. So a lot of Mariners overs probably coming down the pike here. But again, the books have already adjusted, throwing up that 9 at T-Mobile Park for today. All right, let's go down the lines here. Talk about line moves dating back to Thursday. These will be pretty rapid fire in nature because a lot of them are going to have the same hallmarks to them. Saw money come in on San Diego on Thursday. Was that a Madison Bumgarner? Was that just the perception of the Padres? That was Eric Lauer in that start. Did like the Padres. Wish I would have pulled the trigger in the article. The Padres did win that game. But you sort of wonder, was that a perception play on the Padres? Or are there a lot of concerns about the Giants? Or maybe specifically, Madison Bumgarner. Thursday, we saw a fade of Kyle Freeland, about 15 to 20 cents in Miami. Those that faded Kyle Freeland did not get a victory there in that one. Freeland, look, again, using the ERA and xFIP discrepancy will get you in front of line moves. You don't want to blindly dig into those positions. Because, again, xFIP implies a league average home run to fly ball percentage. Kyle Freeland probably won't post one of those. And also, he induces a ton of weak contact. So he has more sustainability to outperform those advanced metrics than a lot of other guys do. So we'll see money come in start after start after start against Freeland. Get your line value. I don't think you want to be tied to that position. You want to explore some arbitrage opportunities or look to buy out in a lot of those situations. Saw a fade of Mike Fiers against the Angels. Once again, low ERA, high xFIP from last season. Also didn't pitch well in Tokyo in the first game. But the difference in that game, and again, I wish I had played this one too. Fiers had made a start. He had gotten out on a major league mound, even though it was out in Tokyo. You know, that can't help. You know, getting that first start, and maybe that'll be an angle that we look at next week as fourth and fifth starters are making their first starts of the year against guys that have already gone out there and pitched. So Jose Berríos, a flip favorite. That was the Indians and Twins game, and a lot of people fading the Indians lineup right now, and I can certainly understand that. But the time to get value on Jose Berríos is right now, because there won't be a lot of it over the course of the summer if he sustains some of that those pitch usage changes that I mentioned in the previous segment. So a big fade of John Lester, that's going to happen week in and week out. Big ERA to xFIP split. Money will come in against John Lester every time he takes the mound. So you probably also want to get involved in that, especially because the Cubs bullpen is it's a nuclear fallout right now. It's a disaster with that Cubs bullpen. That certainly won't help John Lester on his chances either. So look to fade Lester early and often. That's what I'd probably blindly fade, because I think you're going to get a lot of value playing the overnights against Lester, and I wouldn't even buy back. I think take your line value. Expect him to fall off the pace here this season. Friday, we saw a flip favorite, Cardinals and Brewers. And, you know, this is one of those where Jack Flaherty was on the mound for the Cardinals. That was a big reason why. Also, Josh Hader wasn't available. I think there were some people that bought in on the Cardinals because of that. And that was a play that I recommended in my picks and tips piece as well. But I am interested to see how the market approaches this new-look Brewers rotation. That was Freddie Peralta and that one. Corbin Burns with the 12 tickets in Sunday's game. Kind of wonder how the Brewers rotation is going to be approached in the market, because the Brewers used to be a fade pregame with a lot of those ERA and xFIP guys. Well, they probably won't have those now, because as you increase in strikeouts, your FIP gets better, because one of the components of FIP is strikeouts. So that's one of the things that you want to keep in mind here at this time of the year, is that people will probably look to fade the Brewers, not realizing that their starting rotation has a lot more upside this season than it has in some of these past years. We saw Matt Boyd money on the board for the Tigers against the Jays. Matt Boyd, very popular guy in the sabermetric community right now. I still only trust him at home. Had the 10 strikeouts in that game, but also gave up a few runs. And Miguel Cabrera going for x-rays on a hit-by-pitch to the hand. That's not great for a Tigers lineup that already looks to be pretty bad. Money came in against Marco Estrada and the A's on Friday. Look, I think there's something to Marco Estrada at home. I really do. You know, we had a little piece of the A's on Friday there. I think it was a 1% play in the article. I think Estrada can survive there. I really, truly do. The market won't think so. So if you want to trust me and follow me when I do play Estrada, wait it out and get a better number closer to first pitch, because the market is not going to buy into him at all whatsoever. Saw money come in on the Mariners and Yusei Kikuchi in Friday's game. That was the right move. It was a bad opening line. That was Nate Eovaldi minus 150. Bad opening line. I agree with the Mariners' move there in that one. And, you know, Kikuchi is a little bit of an unknown. So the market doesn't really know how to price him yet. I think the betting market will be a little bit more favorable towards him than the odds makers will be. So Kikuchi, probably a guy that you want to watch for some line moves with here this season. Saturday, we saw Noah Syndergaard money coming against Steven Strasburg. Remember, some of these are lineup-induced moves, especially with the lineups coming out at the same time and all the things, you know, with MLB having that partnership with MGM and all that. Some of these are more lineup-induced moves than pitcher-related moves. So, you know, I'm mostly looking at it from a pitcher's standpoint, because I'm looking at line moves. I'm not looking at necessarily the timing of them. But definitely, as you're looking back through and scouring these out, go through and look at the odds screens. Look at the timing of these moves and see if it was based on who was in the lineup and who wasn't. A surprise on Saturday not to see Nick Pivetta money. Pivetta, big ERA, low xFIP. He didn't pitch well. That side did win. But surprising not to see the market hit him with one of those telltale signs with the high ERA and the low xFIP. Saw a big Tyler Anderson fade on Saturday in the Rockies game against the Marlins. That was Pablo Lopez. Pablo Lopez is a Fangraphs bump kind of guy. What I mean by that is, when guys get press at Fangraphs, The Athletic, Hardball Times, baseball prospectus, usually in the next two or three starts, we see money come in on those guys. Pablo Lopez was a guy that was getting some love because of the increased velocity. Money also came in against Tyler Anderson. I mean, it's not just because of that, but you will see that as you go throughout the season here. I think Lopez is an example of that. So money coming in on Trevor Bauer against Jake Odorizzi and the Twins. Bauer is the ace of the staff now, so I would expect line moves on him pretty often here this season. Reynaldo Lopez fade on Saturday for the White Sox against the Royals. That was an ERA to XFIP play. Jake Junis going for the Royals there in that one. The Royals were the right side in that game. Lopez, again, an ERA to XFIP fade guy. Tyler Glasnow money hit the board for the Rays on Saturday. Look for guys like this in the market early on. Tyler Glasnow has got a lot of buzz as well, a lot of helium with him. The market will keep backing these guys early on in the year. They will definitely look to support their preseason positions by backing somebody like a Tyler Glasnow. So watch for that here. A lot of his lines should be moving up as we go throughout the month of April and on into May as well. Saw very heavy steam on Patrick Corbin. That line moved about 35 to 40 cents in that game on Sunday. Thinking the lineups had something to do with it as well, but interesting to see Corbin take that big money move on Sunday. Also big money move on Chris Paddock. Again, one of those Fangraphs bump guys that got a lot of love in spring training. Money came in against the White Sox again on Sunday. Money came in against the White Sox in all of the games in this series. So are the Royals undervalued in the market or are the White Sox that bad? We'll have to wait and see how all these line movements come together. Finally, for Sunday, big fade of Cole Hamels and the Cubs. The Cubs bullpen, just a train wreck again in that game. Hamels, an ERA XFIP fade. Not a big surprise to see that one on Sunday. Looking at Monday here, surprised that we haven't had a line move on the Pirates and Chris Archer. Maybe it's happened while I've been recording. Maybe it'll happen here this afternoon. Archer's an ERA to XFIP guy. I would expect money to come in on him more often than not. Adam Wainwright, not a whole lot of people like him. Now, I'm a little bit surprised that line's not moving. It's one of the reasons why I stayed off of it, because that line wasn't moving. If it keeps going down, I think anywhere in the minus 115 range, Pittsburgh probably worth a play here. So keep an eye on that line. We'll see what happens with it. Zach Davies flipped into a favorite for the Brewers against Tanner Roark and the Reds. You've got a little bit of a fade of the Indians here and their lineup. That's Ivan Nova and Mike Clevenger. Don't really like that line move. I think the Indians are the right side. I really like Clevenger. We won't see many totals of Ivan Nova with 7.5. So that's an interesting one here today. Cold and probably a little bit breezy here in Cleveland. The first home opener I'm not going to since 2002. Chilly day, though. The ball does not carry well in April at Progressive Field. So the 7.5 total probably justified here. Big moves on the side and total for the Rockies-Rays game tonight. Chad Bettis goes up against Ryan Stanek. Then we'll see Ryan Yarbrough follow the opener there in Stanek. I agree with the move on both the side and the total here. Or I disagree with the move on the total, excuse me. I agree with the side move. I think the total at 8.5, maybe a little bit of value to the under. Chad Bettis, a guy, 21st in average exit velocity on ground balls last year, goes to a place where Tampa Bay wants to hit ground balls. I think the total is a little bit high at this point in time. It was 8 when I wrote the article. At 8.5, I may be interested in the under, especially if it's in the minus 110 range. But my official pick for today here on the show, Cubs first five. This is in the minus 110 range. This is Kyle Hendricks against Sean Newcomb. The Cubs last year, I've mentioned this stat before, 64-36 when drawing at least three walks. Sean Newcomb walked 81 in 164 innings last year, 57 in 100 innings in 2017. The Cubs offense has been very good. You know, they scored 28 runs in that series against the Rangers and lost 2 out of 3 because of the pitching staff. I'll take the bullpen out of the equation. I like Kyle Hendricks. I don't love what the Braves look like here so far. So I'll take the Cubs first five, minus 110, as the official pick here. And I also took over 8 because I think that the Cubs do score some runs on Newcomb. And also, these are two atrocious bullpens at this time of the year. So finally, to wrap things up with a look at the week ahead, we start with the Mets and Marlins here. You got Steven Matz and Caleb Smith in the first game today. Jason Vargas, Jose Urena tomorrow, Jacob deGrom, Trevor Richards on Wednesday. Marlins have been taking a lot of money early. Does it continue? I think it probably will. It's happening today, probably happened tomorrow with a fade of Jason Vargas as well. I'd be careful with Matz and Vargas, though. Matz was really good in September last year, started using his slider a little bit more. I think that's probably a sustainable development. And Jason Vargas also pitched pretty well down the stretch last season. So you know, maybe those two guys, a little bit underrated in the marketplace here. Not to say I'm going to dive in on them. May play Vargas tomorrow against Urena. But you know, for right now, I think it's pretty interesting to see the Marlins taking a lot of money and also to see how the Mets are being treated here in the betting market. The Mets play the Nationals next, so good job, schedule makers, to put those two teams together twice in the first 2 weeks of the season. But keep that in mind here with the Mets possibly on Wednesday, you know, having to go and play the Nationals once again. I believe that's on Thursday, and I believe it's the home opener for the Mets as well. So maybe a little bit of a look-ahead factor there for the offense and Jacob deGrom's start. Maybe Wednesday's under, something that you want to look at there. Red Sox and A's. David Price, Aaron Brooks today, Chris Sale, Mike Fiers tomorrow, Nate Eovaldi, Marco Estrada Wednesday, Eduardo Rodriguez and Brett Anderson on Thursday in the getaway day game. I'm not going to have too much activity on this series, I don't think. But what I am interested in seeing is how the market approaches this series. Oakland with an elite bullpen, a good lineup. Red Sox with a much better lineup because they're the best lineup in baseball and a lackluster pitching staff. I want to see how this one is priced, how this one shakes out here. I just to get a feel for the market, you know, just to see where the Reds are being evaluated or the Red Sox are being evaluated and also where the A's are being evaluated. Finally, the last series I'm intrigued about here, the Diamondbacks and the Padres. You know, I think they'll be underdog value throughout this series. Merrill Kelly makes his major league debut for the Diamondbacks here today. He'll go up against Matt Strom, Zach Greinke and Eric Lauer tomorrow, Robbie Ray, Joey Lucchesi on Wednesday. You know, for Greinke, the command was really bad on Thursday. That's another game I got to watch some of on the plane. Wasn't good. Wasn't a good look at all. So was that a sign of something more, or was it just an off day for Greinke? But what I can tell you is, again, I think the Padres are going to be way too big of a favorite in this series overall. If you have the heart to play dogs, usually a pretty good angle. Diamondbacks, you know, their bullpen worked a ton in that series against the Dodgers, had the extra inning game and all that type of stuff. You know, so the Diamondbacks are a tough team to back. But again, if you have the heart, April underdogs are usually pretty profitable because you've got a very, what's the word I'm looking for here? A very reactionary betting market where the Padres played really well against the Giants. There was a lot of steam on them coming into the season anyway. Their prices are going to be inflated. I don't know if I can take the Diamondbacks here. I don't know if I can do it tomorrow or on Wednesday. I didn't do it today. But again, I can tell you that if you're looking to bet numbers and not teams, there's going to be value in fading the Padres here in this series, if that's something that you feel like you can do. So I know I ran long here today and also started this a little bit late. My apologies for that. I'll get into more of a rhythm for the season here as we keep going. Wednesday, I'll chat with Kyle Hunter about the Final Four and the National Championship game. Thursday, I'll be on again. And remember that you will never strike out when you're in the Bettors Box.